Check. Testing, testing. Can you hear okay?
Okay, great.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Bonsho, if I haven't met you. It's nice to see all of you on this beautiful March spring morning here in Oregon. Thank you for coming together and practicing. So I heard once that the Dalai Lama said that once in a while you should take stock and see how your practice is doing, how it's going. You should do it once in a while. And when I asked about this, when you should do this, he said, you should do it every 10 years. Otherwise, don't worry about it. Don't bother. Well, for me, I just hit one of those marks, 20 years. 20 years of Zen practice. So today I want to talk about some of the things I've learned in 20 years. I hope it's encouraging and not discouraging, like, that's it? No. It took him 20 years to figure that out. So know that the small print says that individual results may vary. There's no guarantee that it will take you such a long time to learn what I learned. In fact, my deep aspiration and vow is that it won't take so long. So I'll rattle off the list, kind of get it out of the way, and then unpack some things. So here's some things I've learned. I learned how to meditate. I learned how to work with the inner critic. I learned how to work with thoughts. Learned how to concentrate the mind. Learned how to do koans, maybe. I learned how to be present, the precepts, loving kindness, heart practices, gratitude, how to work with physical pain, how to work with emotional pain, how to be in a relationship, how to quiet the mind, experience no thought, no thinking. I learned about impermanence, how I create my own suffering, how to untangle ancient karma, how to work with a teacher, how to work with my teachers, renunciation, how to follow the way, vows, how to let go, sit sesshin, serve, how to be in community, how to roof. It's true. I've learned a lot of practical skills too. How to say yes, how you can practice anywhere and everywhere, and how practice is anywhere and everywhere. So I want to unpack some of these things. Definitely not all of them. And so a little bit about 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, Jomon, who's sitting over there, wanted to check out this monastery that she had heard about due to a controversy here in Klatskanai when it opened. She was working in St. Helens at the time and was reading the newspaper in the break room. So some of you may not know there are these paper things that we used to have. I know everyone here is old enough to remember newspaper, but not for long. So she was actually reading the newspaper in the break room, and it said there was a Zen monastery that had opened here, and there was a vocal group of people who were opposed to it or worried about it. They were worried that the Buddhists were maybe spreading Satan, might even eat children. But Oregon has had its own karma about religious communities opening up in rural areas. So it's not too surprising. But the controversy was definitely worth putting in the newspaper. So on Sunday, February 15th, 2004, Jomon and I walked through the door as newcomers. Is anyone here for the first time? This is what's coming. So Jomon and I walked through the door as newcomers. It was Valentine's Day weekend, and we had spent the weekend in Astoria. Jomon had to convince me to get up early and forego a walk on the beach to come check out this place for a possible personal retreat. Now, this Valentine's weekend was during a renewal after a really tough time in our relationship. We just finished months and months of really difficult couples therapy. We weren't married yet, but eventually we would. Spoiler alert. And at the outset of that couples therapy, we really didn't know if we were going to make it as a couple. We had a very skilled therapist, and we were both worked really, really hard. Interestingly enough, our therapist's name was what she went by the name Mary Ananda. So a little Buddhist. Ananda is the name of the, for those of you who don't know, it's the name of the Buddha's attendant, longtime attendant. So she took on that name. So at the conclusion of that process of couples therapy, one of the things that we learned, among lots of things that we learned, that I learned for sure, is that we needed a spiritual dimension, spiritual foundation, or some way to communication within our relationship if it was really going to last or if it was going to go deeper. So we were looking and we looked at lots of different places. That's a whole other story. I was telling Daishin, who I've known, who's here from Canada, who met 20 years ago, that during that time I tried lots of things. I tried to be Catholic, which was the religious tradition of my birth, and it just wasn't going to work out. But I was not looking so hard that I thought that it was a good idea to skip the beach and go to Great Vow, but I relented. So we were one of those people that says, if there's someone new to the monasteries, please meet so-and-so in the back of the Zendo and go into the guest area for beginning instruction. So I was one of those people who was greeted here and new. And so for those of you who offer beginning instruction or greet people, you never know who's going to walk through the door. And for those of you who are new, you never know where you'll end up. So this is one thing. This is the number one thing for practice that I learned, which is we just don't know. We actually just don't know. And this is one of the things that our practice really invites us to do, is to really do the practice of only not knowing. It's only when we think that we know how things are that we kind of skip over our life in many ways. We can get in routines and lose track of just the wonder that's present just in living, just in being alive. So our practice in a way is, not in a way, our practice is practicing not knowing, being completely present with the breath just as it is, and not assuming like, oh, breathing, I've done that how many, millions of times, but I haven't breathed this breath with these sounds, in this place, with this body. So that our practice is one of not knowing. And then that extends into our life in lots of ways. So was the crisis in our relationship that Jomana and I had, was that good or bad? In the midst of it, it sucked. It was terrible. It was really hard. At the end of it, going through it, the relationship was stronger. It was different. I was different. It was transformed in that cauldron of that process. So looking back, it was the impetus for even stepping on the path. It was part of that. I can't sort of tease that part out like, oh, that was a detour. I have no idea what would have happened without it. Was the big protest that happened here at the monastery, was that good or bad? If it hadn't happened, it wouldn't have been in the newspaper. Jomon never would have read about it. we may never have come here. I may have been walking in today as a newcomer, or maybe never even heard of Great Vow, never met my teachers, never started walking the path. So we don't know how it will turn out. And so having that kind of curiosity and what can I learn? What could this situation, even if it's difficult, be teaching me? So the number two thing I learned is the Buddha was right. The Buddha was right. I haven't found anything that I've practiced in all these years where, the Buddha famously said, don't just believe it because I say it, but try it out for yourself. He said that in many different kinds of ways, but fundamentally that's true. This is not a path of you have to believe this. Now, it helps to have a certain amount of faith or trust, enough to try it out and give it a good go. Say, oh, I'm going to move forward with some trust or faith. But the Buddha always said, try it for yourself. So I haven't found one thing yet that the Buddha said that didn't, once I kind of tried it out, didn't end up being true. Now, I haven't tried everything out. You know, there's like volumes, still learning. But the fundamental truth that the Buddha taught was that human beings, being human is not so easy. It's often said as, you know, we talk about the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, or as Hogen Roshi likes to say, the Four Noble Observations. These are things that we can observe. So one is the First Noble Truth, is that being human being, you'll encounter difficulties, stress, friction, and that there is some pervading sense of dissatisfaction. Whenever we get comfortable, we end up uncomfortable. People change. We like our job, then we don't like our job. We like this relationship, then we don't like this relationship. We like this piece of pizza that we're eating. Now we're on the third piece of pizza. It's not so good anymore. And human beings, it's dissatisfaction or friction. There's this kind of grating. And as we practice, we can see more and more subtle ways that this happens, where it's like, oh, there's something that feels off. Now, the second noble truth or noble observation is that often this stress, friction, this dissatisfaction, this grating, that the source is right here. It oftentimes comes from the way that I'm relating to what's happening, relating to reality. That I think things should be different than they are. Or that I think that I know how things actually are and they should be different. And I may not actually know how things are at all. But basically that we look at the way that we relate to our reality, the main way that the Buddha talked about is either clinging, I want this, I want more of this, I don't want this to end, or aversion, I don't want this, get this away from me, I don't like this, I want to change it, needs to be different. And so the way that we relate to so that oftentimes we have this internal dissatisfaction, and it comes from the way that we relate to things by pushing away or clinging to things. So one of the things that, and then the third observation is that we can kind of get out of this cycle, that there's a way out of this cycle. And that there's a path to do that, path of meditation and precepts. So there's a way, so you can try that out for yourself. I tried it, so far so good. And that the main part of this is one of the things that causes us a lot of struggle is the mind untrained. The way that we relate to things, particularly through thoughts, gets in the way of our wonder at things, the innate wonder and luminosity of things, of our life. That so one of the things that we learn here in this, particularly when you practice here with this community, is looking at our thoughts. What thoughts am I believing about the way things are, and are they true? And when I believe those thoughts about the way things are, what is my life like? So the Buddha was right. The ancestors, all the Zen ancestors, so far so good. So the third learning, I guess, I think third thing I would like to encourage us to, that I learned that was important, was vow. Vow as in V-O-W, like great vow, this place. That practice can only go so far if we're just practicing for ourselves. That if we lose sight of the fact, we're always practicing in relationship with others and within our own life. But if we only are practicing for ourselves, that, well, one thing is that once we, if we come to practice, we often come to practice because, as Jomon says, things aren't so awesome. We might be struggling, have difficulty in our life, pain. And that as we practice, things clear up. Our mind can become more calm. We become less reactive. Those things are wonderful and beautiful and is an important part of our practice. And we can, if we're not careful, we can have blinders to how that, and only relate to our own internal experience. And so the Bodhisattva vow that we talk about is that we practice so that others might benefit. And then as we learn more, we learn that there's actually no separation between self and others, and there's actually no others. But this Bodhisattva vow, this vow to may my practice help other people, can provide immense fuel. So I remember in a sesshin one time an insight that came in this regard. I was trying to concentrate my mind on the breath, and it was really difficult. It was a struggle, breath after breath after breath. I could not concentrate, period after period after period. I was despondent, I was desperate. I can't do this. I can't do this, I can do this, I can't do this. You can do it, you can do it. No, I can't, no, I can't. I want to do this, I want to do this, I want to be able to concentrate. No, I don't want to do this, this sucks. It's no fun. I don't want to do this. And just a real struggle, a lot of striving energy, a lot of self-achievement energy. Like my self-concept relied on whether or not I could do this thing that I wanted to do. And then at some point, what bubbled up in the midst of that, in that real, real painful kind of inner critic type of entanglement, one of the things that bubbled up in that was just a calm, quiet, I can't even say it was really a thought, although it manifested as a thought after this feeling, this shift, which was very simple, which is, I want to follow this breath so that I can help others. May this being with the breath benefit other people. May it allow serving to happen. May it allow helping to happen. And that changed things. The struggle was gone. And then, of course, it came back at another point, because that habit of mind, that conditioning, is continued to be able to work with. But this this orientation to having a larger view that the Bodhisattva vow encourages us is really important fuel for practice. And so the more that we can nurture that aspect of bodhicitta, it's called, which is that inclination to practice for the benefit of others, the more that we can nurture that bodhicitta, it provides a fuel. I talked about working with physical pain, which is when we practice is inevitable, particularly when we do long retreats. A lot of times we think if we're feeling physical pain that there's something wrong. I'm doing something wrong. My body is wrong. Zen is wrong. There's something wrong if I'm feeling physical pain. So, and physical pain is a sensation that can have all kinds of ways that it appears: sharp, dull, and throbbing, and sharp, intense, not so intense. But one of the things that working with, if we're able to sit with physical pain or discomfort within reason, I mean, there's a whole bunch of gradations around that, but within reason, one is that we're practicing presence with whatever comes, not just what I want. And physical pain is a way to be with something that we don't want. We can watch our state of mind when something arises. And because we're in the zendo, because we're sitting, we can see how our mind operates. But it's not just a mental game. It's not just a like mental achievement type of thing. There is something with excruciating pain. A situation I remember sitting with, I had made this, we were sitting in a sesshin, which is one of our week-long silent retreats here. And at a certain point, Hogan was leading the sesshin and turned out the lights. And we were sitting in the dark, which is a beautiful practice. You know, when the sort of visual field is, when the visual field sort of changes in that way into darkness. But sitting with that, so I made a practice intention. The lights are out and nobody can see, I'm not gonna move. And I'm gonna just sit stably. And for whatever reason, I began to feel like over time, because the period seemed to never end, it just went on and on, for endless kalpas, as they say, that excruciating pain came. And the thing about that excruciating pain is that I wanted to get out of it, and I was noticing how the mind related to that and wanted to get out of this experience. And then again, like, how can this serve? How can this be? What can I learn from this? And one of the things that occurred to me, doesn't have to be your reason for working with this, is that I felt like if I could be present with the experience of excruciating pain, then at the hour of death, if I were dying in excruciating pain, that I could be present with life at that time. I was even picturing you know, people that I love very dearly, saying, I can be present with excruciating pain and be with, be where my mind, where I want my mind and heart to be. So vows are very important. And so it's something to consider in terms of what are our vows? What is my life about? And we do a retreat here on vows. The Bodhisattva vow is to benefit others, to practice to benefit others. That, of course, can show up in all kinds of ways. If we're a caregiver, if we're a parent, that's benefiting others in quite direct ways. So Tori Zenji, who's an ancient Zen master, said this about vows. The correct course for cultivating practice is based on vows. If the strength of your vows is deep and weighty, demons and outsiders cannot disturb you. If the strength of your vows is slight and superficial, you will encounter many obstacles. So if we have the vow is changes our perspective to be wide, deep. We did a whole retreat on that. There's a lot more that could be said about vow. But in terms of in 20 years, I learned that having a vow or being clarifying one's vows is vital for continuing on the path. Because then whatever comes towards you, if you're aligned with your vow, then whatever comes towards you, whatever appears to be an obstacle, is simply the result of the vow. It's simply part of the vow. So example is like when one of the reasons why I moved here is a result of my own personal heart vows to serve the Sangha, and also my own personal heart vows to awaken and help others. So then, even then, the sort of like small types of things, like all the pains in the butt that comes from trying to pack up things and move somewhere and all that other stuff, then it just becomes like, oh, well, I made this vow and this is part of it. So caring for someone, if this is part of your vow, it's like, well, if then all the supposed problems just become, this is because I made this vow. So the fourth thing I wanted to say is a teacher is important. Having a guide on the path is really important. This is my learning. So, and this is actually really against the stream in our culture. We live in a very DIY, go it alone, especially in our culture here, and very individualistic. And we live in a very consumer-oriented world. You know, we go on Amazon, we're Netflix, and all the recommendations are based on our individual preferences. We have algorithms that are set up to cater to our inclinations in order to keep us engaged, keep our attention. Like right now, you know, Facebook is showing me every other post are pictures from 90s grunge bands, an 80s new wave. And on Instagram, I get a constant feed of golden retrievers and owls. So you know what I've been up to. So catering to our preferences can be a real trap on the spiritual path. because we're used to, in fact, more and more getting, you know, being able to like basically shop around. And is that, does that lead to spiritual maturity or not? Does that lead to maturity or not, getting what we want? I mean, those of us who've matured, is it, you know, look at the ways that you've matured in your life. Is it because you got what you wanted or told what you wanted? So I feel really fortunate when I came to the Dharma that it was a time of iPods. So I could rip CDs and Dharma talks and listen, or download talks, but there was like no YouTube at the time, right? We didn't have access. I think now we have lots of access and it can be really confusing. And, you know, we can learn 100 different practices and master none of them. If we go on our preferences, we run the risk of being pulled around by our own reactivity. You know, it's like, and so it's like trying to dig a well, you know, digging down a foot and saying, well, there's no water here. I'll go over this other place and start digging. And then we dig a foot down. Oh, there's still no water here. I'll try this other place. Oh, there's roots in here. And so, oh, it's really hard. So there's all these roots here. I can't quite get through there. It's tangled roots. It's too hard. I'll go dig over here. And having a teacher doesn't preclude us from doing these things anyway. But it sure helps us kind of get out of those kinds of things. One of the hallmarks of the Zen school is that it is socially oriented. We're doing this practice. We think like, oh, I'm doing this practice. And then this person sitting next to me is doing their practice. But we practice in community. A lot of us talk about, you know, a lot of people want community. And that's what we enact here. We enact community. We manifest community. This moving around together is being community. The Zen forms, the bowing together, the sitting together. We manifest community moving in harmony. But the Zen school is socially oriented in that it's all the stories are interactions. Almost all the stories are interactions between students and students, talking to each other, challenging each other, ribbing each other, questioning each other, teachers and students talking to each other. You know, there's, for those of you who don't, like, you know, one of the stories is there's a famous koan or Zen story that points to something important, where there's a group of monks, a group of practitioners, they're looking at a flag. One group of monks says, the flag is moving. The other group of monks says, no, the flag's not moving, the wind is moving. And then some really deep person walks up and says, it's not the flag that's moving, it's not the wind that's moving, it's your mind that's moving. That's all in interactivity, sociality. And so that's one of the things about that we're not practicing quietude and like, I need to escape to my comfortable place, but it's like function is important in the Zen school. And so that the way that that happens, it can happen if you choose it, is by working with a teacher. And there's a beautiful, I want to just read a beautiful thing about this, about teachers and students. This is from the Hong Zhe, who's a Chinese teacher from the 1100s. And it's called, from his practice instructions, it's called Spectacular Images of Clouds and Dragons. And in this poetical language, clouds represent, in this case, monks. Monks, because they float around and travel teacher to teacher, they're called unsui, clouds and water, is a novice monk. And dragons represent teachers or adepts, people who are wise people. So they may be official teachers, but not necessarily. So he says, in the wind abode, clouds and dragons harmoniously follow each other. Very naturally, from the first, they do not need to express their intentions to each other. Similarly, patch-robed monks are accommodating and based on causes and conditions can harmoniously practice together. So that's us. Arriving without display, emerging unconcealed, the wondrous clouds and dragons enter the whole scene and cannot be confused. Casually hanging above the 10,000 features, each distinctly presents a spectacular image. Complete, without a hair's breadth difference between them, springing forth with spontaneity, they, meaning clouds and dragons, clearly exemplify coming home. But still, they must investigate until they have eaten their full fill. Still, they must investigate until they have eaten their fill. Clouds disperse and winds die down. The autumn sky clears and the moon sets. The waters of heaven are limitless. Where the ground is on its own, the brightness begins to be realized. So, clouds and dragons exemplify coming home, coming back to the source, coming to what's fundamental. But still, they must investigate until they eat their fill. They have to do it for themselves. So in Zen, relationships are sacred in just this way, and ordinary too. So how do you find a teacher? It helps if they're physically close. It's helpful to know what their training is. Does what they're saying make sense? Does it inspire? Is there some affinity? But you don't need to fall in love, though. It's probably better that you don't. But just that there's some kind of, just begin, like any relationship. It takes time. It takes time to get to know each other. So people who are here, we meet face-to-face, you know, all the time. But those of us who are householder types, as I was one for most of this 20 years, we have to make the effort to make the time. So go all the time. Like any relationship, it takes time to do it. And we have to step forward and work with our stuff, all the things that come up. So one, working with a teacher allows us to kind of get past our own sort of self-referential process. And you're working with someone who has been doing it, and you get another point of view. The other thing that comes up is all our habitual reactivity around working with a teacher. And that, for some of us, that can show up as like, oh, I need to be the good student. Oh, I need to get it right. Oh, I don't like teachers. So there can be all kinds of both attraction and repulsion. All those habits of mind show up, and that becomes part of the process. So, but fundamentally, though, the teacher can't practice for us. You have to do it ourselves. They can't practice. So you have to have confidence and trust in yourself as you go along the way. So it's like it's kind of two poles. On the one hand, we don't want to be pushed around by preferences and reactivity. On the other hand, we have to have confidence in our own ability to walk the path. And that being in relationship, there's like, can be a catalyst to move forward. So you can push back. You don't have to, this isn't a walking in and saying like, tell me what to do. And we practice willingness. Allow ourselves to be pushed. And the more that we continue and step forward in relationship, the bigger you can risk the relationship in order to deepen things. I don't think I've ever, I can't say that. There are a few times I've been more angry than storming out of Sanzen with Hogan in a Sashin. Because I was being pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and fuming coming back from Sanzen. And then plopping back on the cushion and then going, oh. Complete with without a hair's difference between them, springing forth in spontaneity, they clearly exemplify coming home, but still must investigate until they have eaten their fill. So walking the path, finally, I'll just say that, you know, this does require some devotion and renunciation, letting go. There is an element of renunciation on the path. We let go of things. You know, there are many ways to do this, of course, and that looks different for everyone. But one way that we do that is we prioritize spiritual practice above other things. And we do it as best we can in our circumstances. And renunciation is like, what am I clinging? What can look at one way is like, well, what am I clinging to? And does it serve me? What am I distracting myself with? But how do we let go? The important thing is that the letting go actually comes from just turning our attention to something that's something else. That's how you let go. So we turn our attention away from whatever is hindering us, turn our attention to practice, spiritual practice. So I became devoted to coming to the Zendo. That's how I started 20 years ago. I had a very hectic job, very busy career, working on the weekends, 60-hour weeks. But I made a vow early on that I would always go every Sunday night, whether I wanted to or not. I would always go to Sanzen if it was offered, whether or not I had a question, whether or not I had anything to say, whether or not I wanted to see Hogan, didn't matter. I would always go. If it was offered, I would go. And I would always go to Sashin. And so for many years, every vacation day, was devoted to Sashin. Now that's not for everyone, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm gonna renounce watching baseball games at night. One of my first renunciations, since I was going on Sunday nights, was renouncing The Simpsons. Couldn't watch The Simpsons anymore. But I wasn't like, oh, I'm renouncing The Simpsons. But I ended up renouncing The Simpsons. But it was because I had made a determination. This was really important to me. So after 2004, I just don't know any more Simpsons references. Sorry. And for a while, I renounced following sports. I was like, this is, you know, but it was because my life was filled up with Zen. And then that changed. Now I follow baseball again and do Zen. But so look at how we can turn towards this, that is coming from not should, but attraction. Like, oh, I'm drawn to this. So all of these things can help with that. Vow, working with a teacher that you resonate with and are excited about, working, being in community, practicing being in community. All of these things help. So this devotion developed as a devotion, eventually became from devoted to Zen practice, my own practice and learning, to being devoted to the community, to being devoted to my teachers, and now to share whatever I can, including what was ever in this talk. So I hope there was something in here that might be useful to you and help you. And if there's anything left unsaid or any questions, I'm happy to answer any. Thank you for your attention.